One of the things that unifies liberals and conservatives is our love of dogs, which is kind of a factor in the first story we'll be talking about today on Today in Ohio. It's the news podcast discussion from Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer. I'm Chris Quinn here with Lisa Garvin, Layla Tassi, and Laura Johnston, and Lisa gets to go to the dogs. How many reporters can say they played a role in preventing people from ending up with sick and dying dogs? State House reporter Jake Zuckerman might well deserve an award for this one. What's the bipartisan bill that was introduced this week that could save some puppies if it can get past a fairly big roadblock? Lisa.
House Bill 443 is co-sponsored by Democrat Michelle Grimm of Toledo and Republican Sarah Carruthers of Butler County. It seeks to reverse a 2016 preemption law that banned cities from making stricter laws to regulate the sale of puppies from puppy mills. There's a Tuesday hearing yesterday in the House Government Oversight Committee, the first hearing on this bill. It says that retail pet stores are notorious for sourcing their dogs from high volume breeders, and they are prone to health issues and premature deaths, as Jake Zuckerman's story so tearfully pointed out, and owners that bought dogs that got sick immediately and died within a year. In testimony yesterday before the committee, Grimm singled out the Southeast Ohio-based Petland stores, which Jake wrote about. Lawmakers say that it preempts local regulation instead of promoting shelter adoptions. Why don't they do that instead? Back in 2013, the cities of Toledo and Grove City passed local restrictions against puppy mill sales, but that led to the law change by mostly Republican representatives. So they say this bill is pretty far from certain for passage. The Oversight Committee Chair, Representative Bob Peterson, sponsored the 2016 preemption law, and they have a short legislative calendar right now because summer break and elections are coming up.
This was like the tobacco law that they recently passed. It made absolutely no sense to do what they did, so they must have been bought off by the pet store industry. And the result has been horrible suffering. I mean, we are allowing the pet stores to subsidize cruelty at puppy mills. And Jake laid it all out. It was heartbreaking to see these people bring home these dogs, fall in love with them, and then have them die pretty much before their eyes. And it's interesting to me that in this incredibly divided legislature, dog lovers exist. Nobody wants to see a dog die. You know, Ted Dieden loves his dog as much as Laura loves her dog. I mean, this is the universal. So it actually brought the two sides together to say, we got to stop this. We got to let cities like Toledo block this so that we can get some humanity here. It's going to be fascinating to watch people, now that there'll be a debate because they're advocates, try and defend it. No. I'm all for making dogs suffer and fall to cruelty. They ought to fast track this. I'm trying to figure out, we're having a conversation about this, how do we keep a focus on it? How do we keep people looking at this? Because puppies move people. So maybe we can do some good.
I think we could dig into, the puppy mills themselves, because these are retail stores that are getting their dogs from these puppy mills. Maybe we can do a series about that, although it would be hard to find information. That would take a lot of investigative digging, I'm sure.
Yeah, we could just highlight more cases of people who are tormented by what happened. I mean, and this is apart from the money. I mean, these people paid a lot of money to get these puppies, and then they died, and Petland jerked them around a good bit to get to the finish line. But this is really about animal suffering. I salute the legislators for doing it. They are going up against the powerful person that put the original bill in, and let's see him defend it now.
Another thing I think that we could go after, too, is the usurious interest rates on these dogs. I mean, I think they were like approaching 100% interest, I think, in some cases.
You're right. It's the whole thing is a big mess. And major salute to Jake, because he brought this back. His story put this front and center, and nobody wants to see dogs suffer. You're listening to Today in Ohio. We had some strong words for Ohio Republican leaders yesterday about their absurd tactics in keeping Joe Biden potentially off the November ballot in our state. Wednesday came word that the absurdity just might end. Layla, what happened?
Well, Ohio Senate President Matt Huffman issued some reassurances that one way or another, Joe Biden will end up on the ballot. He said the specifics will depend on whether Democrats propose an administrative fix via the rules of the National Democratic Party or a legislative fix. Excuse me. But he suggested he thinks even a lawsuit would likely succeed. And that's because the Supreme Court, in ruling that states couldn't ban Donald Trump from the ballot, raised concerns about how inconsistent rulings by states in a presidential election could undermine the integrity of a national election. And basically, Huffman said he doesn't think the U.S. Supreme Court would stand for permitting a state to ban a candidate based on the state's own obscure law. And this all, of course, stems from Secretary of State Frank LaRose saying that Joe Biden might not make the ballot because the state law says political parties have to finalize their presidential candidates 90 days before the November election, and that deadline falls on August 7th this year. That's about 2 weeks before the Democratic National Convention makes Joe Biden's nomination official. In the past, lawmakers have passed one-time extensions to accommodate those later conventions, and that happened in 2012 and 2020. In those years, both parties' conventions fell after the deadline to make the ballot, but this time, when it's just the Democratic nominee in question, nothing has been proposed yet to rectify that. And Republicans say they're waiting on the Democrats, and the Democrats say they're waiting to see what the National Party wants to do. But at least it sounds like, you know, some Republicans, many, most, really feel that it's important to address this issue and make sure that everybody gets to vote for their candidate of choice.
Yeah, I mentioned yesterday, our readers are getting worried about this because of the cavalier attitude of the Republicans. The minute this came up, the Republicans were giggling. Ha, 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 look at the idiot Democrats. And instead of, because they run the state, they have all the statewide positions, instead of saying, uh-oh, we got a problem that affects a large number of people we represent, let's find a solution, they all played their little games. Even Dave Yost got in lockstep with the rest of them, sending a note saying, you can't do that, you can't do that. Instead of looking for the way to get it done, instead of using his job as the chief law guy to say, here's the ways we can get this done, guys. We can't leave our voters out of it. What we did yesterday was put huge pressure on them. We said, this isn't a Democratic thing. This is a Republican thing. And they're all playing semantics instead of preserving our sacred right to vote. I think that resonated. I know people were screaming about it because I've been hearing from them. And I think even Matt Huffman realizes, oh, no, if this starts to look like Republican shenanigans to mess with the Democratic candidate, that's not going to play well. And they're doing the right thing. I mean, we hope they do the right thing. At least there's some reassurance that they're not going to play games with something as serious as this. Shame on them for starting this. But now that they know the spotlight is on them, they don't want it. They don't want anything to do with that. I think they will do the right thing.
I think it's really interesting and ironic that LaRose has been chastising the Democrats for their inexcusable, careless error in scheduling this when they did. But when this happened in 2012, LaRose was a state senator, and he was the one to propose the legislative fix, and he was roundly thanked for finding a way to accommodate the two conventions and finding a way for all Ohioans to vote for their candidate. And now he's playing this game. I was glad to see that detail was in the story today.
Yeah. We say it all the time. These guys are putting party over the people, which is what they did here. Oh, look, the Democrats are in a jam. Ha, ha, ha. Let's mess with them. And they all did it. I was really disappointed. Dave Yost went on Twitter yesterday and said, you know, I defend the law. That's my job, blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, you represent Ohioans. You represent the rights of Ohioans, and you should be first in line to defend their right to have a say in the election and play instead of playing these semantic games. Look, he did what he did. When he runs for governor, we're going to make sure people are aware of it. If it were up to Dave Yost, you wouldn't be voting on a Democratic candidate in the race. You are listening to Today in Ohio. Maria Shriver is a journalist, author, and activist, and now she'll have a role in bobbing women's health at our biggest employer in Greater Cleveland. What will she be doing, Laura?
This is so cool. This is a new women's health center at the Cleveland Clinic. She's going to serve as the chief visionary and strategic advisor of what's called Women's Comprehensive Health and Research Center. Now, this is not a new building at the clinic. It's a portal that connects women with a patient navigator. So it's going to focus on the key areas of access, connectivity, education, research, innovation, and try to empower women to navigate their own healthcare. So that means doing a couple of things: streamlining the appointment process, enhancing outreach programs, prioritizing health equity. And these patient navigators are going to be helping to do that, because if you're trying to figure out maybe what's wrong with you or where to get help, it can be a very confusing system if you don't have a general practitioner, or even if you do, who's telling you this is the next step. So this involves behavioral health, breast health, infant and maternal health, endocrinology, weight management, menopause, osteoporosis, and metabolic bone density, as well as healthy aging. And a part of that is Alzheimer's, which Maria Shriver has been really at the forefront of promoting and advocating for more research, because two-thirds of the Alzheimer's patients in the United States are women, and that is what her mother suffered from.
The power of celebrity to focus attention on issues can't be overestimated. And the Cleveland Clinic over the years has managed that fairly well. Who's the ice skater that kept coming back?
Scott Hamilton.
Yeah. I mean, he was huge for bringing attention. And to have Maria Shriver in Cleveland talking about this, it brings a focus to it. It's wonderful that they're trying to get attention on it.
And Shriver is not just a celebrity here. Like, she has been working on the Alzheimer's issue for years. And what she says is this is a big and bold and brave assertion at a time when the big, bold, and brave ideas are needed. So she's partnered with the clinic in the past. She's the founder of the Women's Alzheimer's Movement Prevention and Research Center in Las Vegas, where the Cleveland Clinic has its Nevada campus. And she started talking to Dr. Barry Ridgway a year ago in Vegas, and they discussed how their mom suffered from this lack of quality health care. And they've been working on the center ever since. So it's not like they just called in a big name to make this announcement. She has been integral in the formation of this and to try to make it easier for women to get the help they need. They have a phone number to reach this welcome line for the Women's Health Center. And I hope that if you call this, they'll tell you what to do next. It's 216-444-8686.
Yeah, you're right. Her dedication to this is clear, so I expect we'll be seeing her in Cleveland a few more times as this thing continues to grow. You're listening to Today in Ohio. How much office space has been converted to residential in Cleveland in recent years? And Lisa, how does that compare to the rest of the nation?
In a report from the CBRE real estate firm, they say that Cleveland has the highest percentage in the United States of office space conversions to residential at 11%. So 3.5 million square feet of downtown office space has been converted since 2016. That's actually an 18% reduction in total office inventory. And the vacancy rate has also dropped by about 2.5%. There are 114 residential units that went in at 75% Public Square, another 205 units at 55 Public Square, right downtown. So now the population of downtown residents is 21,000, and they expect to hit 26,000 by 2032.
When you think back to what the population of downtown was around the time Layla was becoming a reporter in Cleveland, it's staggering how much that has changed. I'll never forget the first time I was driving downtown and I saw somebody walking a dog. And It was the most unusual thing you could see in downtown because nobody lived there. And now it's becoming a village. It's fascinating that we're number one, according to this report. We needed a strategy during the pandemic as downtown vacuumed out to try and bring it back. This dates to before the pandemic, but wow, those are staggering numbers.
Yeah, we have the highest percentage, but when you look at square feet, Houston beats us because they've converted more square feet, but not as much of a percentage of their office space.
Yeah, Houston is just so much more of a mega city than Cleveland is. But it is making it, the problem is you still don't have downtown playgrounds. You still have roads that are way too wide that you could narrow and create bike paths. And so if you really want downtown to be the village where people live, we got to get some more amenities down there to make that work. You're listening to Today in Ohio. The Ohio Senate is moving on legislation to make it a crime to do something that should obviously be a crime. Layla, what is it?
So believe it or not, husbands who live with their wives are exempt from laws that prohibit them from drugging their spouse to prevent resistance to sex. And for sex crimes like sexual battery or sexual imposition, the law carves out an exception for anyone who is the spouse of the offender. Since the late 70s, states have been repealing these marital exceptions to sex crimes, and Ohio, of course, is one of 11 states that still has one on the books. House Bill 161, however, is seeking to close that archaic loophole for good here. The bill says that husbands, like any other aggressor, can be held criminally accountable for rape, sexual battery, unlawful sexual conduct with a minor, gross sexual imposition, and sexual imposition when the victim is their spouse. It passed the Ohio House last fall, 74-1, with one chauvinist from Xenia, Representative Bill Dean, voting no because, in his words, "I personally don't believe that a man, if he's married and has physical relations with his wife, that that can be considered rape." The Ohio Senate just held its second hearing on the bill, during which lawmakers heard testimony from women who were victims of sexual assault by their spouses. Several anti-sexual assault advocates said Ohio's loophole sometimes precludes women from receiving emergency domestic violence protective orders, which trigger legal protections to shield them from abusers because of this loophole here. So the message that they were rallying behind is that women do not give up their bodily autonomy at the altar, and that Ohio law has used marriage to protect perpetrators of sexual violence for far too long.
So the guy who voted against this, he's basically arguing that when you get married, you are your husband's sexual slave.
Right.
Man.
Right. I can't see any other way to what? And he's what is this guy thinking?
And he's in the legislature. I mean, what is going on with this state? That's amazing to me that what. Wow. Okay. Well, moving on. You're listening to Today in Ohio. The West Side Market vendors and patrons were raising another ruckus over the weekend because of the windstorm. Laura, what happened and what do they want to do to fix it?
They want generators, but the West Side Market managers say that's not going to fix the problem wholesale because there's a lot of other things that need to get fixed first. So the West Side Market closed on Saturday, April 13th because of this electrical outage. And it wasn't like the power was out to the entire building. It was on Friday night from, you know, mid-Friday night to early Saturday morning. But then there was a power surge. So while the electricity came back on in most of the building, it did not come in the refrigerated display cases on the main floor of the West Side Market. That's where you see all of the goodies you would want to buy and eat, all of the meats and cheeses and cakes. And they didn't work. They couldn't sell. So that part of the market was closed on that Saturday. They still opened the produce side, and some of the regular vendors from the other side went over to the produce side to try to sell something. But that's a busy day, a Saturday, and they were unable to sell. So they're upset. And the managers of the West Side Market say, we get it, but other improvements need to come first, because even if they had generators, that wouldn't necessarily prevented a surge.
Hey, these are folks that don't have the ability to buy their own generators. They're not allowed to do that. And so when they sign up to be vendors in this place, they're doing it in good faith that the lights will be on and the heat will be on and they'll be able to conduct their business. It's a bit stunning that they don't have generators after all these years.
It is. And that's in the works. And they're planning all of these upgrades. Electrical service to the building was updated in 2022. There's capital repairs proposed for the internal electrical system. But this is a century-old building. And it seems like for a whole long time, there were no upgrades. You get the feeling this place is being held together by electrical tape, right? And one thing can just blow up the entire system. So they're saying, even if we added the generators right now, it's no guarantee it's going to fix everything because of all these other things we need to upgrade first.
I'm not buying that. I mean, it's not that hard. They put electric generators everywhere. This is a place that runs on refrigeration because they have meat. If they don't have power, their whole stock goes bad.
Yeah.
Back in Mike White's days as mayor, they did a massive reinvestment in the freezers and things. They probably still have the same ones. I'm surprised they didn't do it then, but this is something that ought to be put on a fast track because this just isn't fair to either the patrons or the vendors.
I agree. I mean, to say, well, we're working on it doesn't seem like very helpful response from the managers when these people are out their livelihood.
I'm surprised it hasn't been an issue more frequently. You're listening to Today in Ohio. If ornamental pear trees are illegal in Ohio, why are they all over the place in Greater Cleveland, Lisa?
Because municipalities and other public areas have been planting them since the 1960s. But in January 2023, it became illegal in Ohio to plant or sell Bradford pear trees, also known as the Callery pear or Pyrus caleriana. That's the Latin name. It's been on the Ohio Agricultural Department invasive list since 2018, but they gave a 5-year grace period so nurseries could sell off their existing stock. So many more got planted in that grace period. And like I said, they're used extensively by cities and parks and also in medians and parking lots. So back in the 1960s, they tried to create the perfect ornamental tree. So they wanted it to be quick growing, small in size, sterile flowers, but it cross-pollinated in the wild. And so it got escaped into the wild and it became fruiting. And they're very fragile. They break off in windstorms. They can cause power outages or damage to your home. They also smell bad, apparently. And the agricultural department says they're working with online sellers who are continuing to sell Bradford pear trees to Ohio gardeners. They do crowd out native trees once they escape into the wild. They say if you have one, this is gardening editor, Susan Brownstein, she says, if you have one, you should really remove it and remove it now before it starts to fruit. And then you have to apply herbicide to that fresh cut to prevent suckers. And anyone who has crabapple trees knows suckers are a pain in the butt. And she says there are good replacement trees that look just as nice. The serviceberry looks a lot like the Bradford pear with its white blossoms. Also, the eastern redbud or arrowwood viburnum are good replacement trees.
What, it's such a long list of plants that we have brought here that were not native that have run amok. We constantly think we can control Mother Nature. We get this tree and we think it won't be able to propagate. And then guess what? It propagates. So it's kind of a nightmare. I wonder if people are very aware of this. How do you know if you have one of these?
That's a good question. I would think, you know, especially if you move into a house that already has the tree, you may not know what it is. You know, if you're planting it, obviously you know what it is. And actually, Susan said, well, if you see your neighbor planting one, you might want to say, hey, that's not a good idea if you feel comfortable doing that with your neighbor.
It's amazing the topic Susan comes up with for that column. They're either helpful or newsworthy or illuminating as this one is. You are listening to Today in Ohio. In the first quarter of this year, Layla, how many refugees moved to Cleveland and where did they mostly come from?
Reporter Zach Smith tells us that 906 refugees from 32 countries came to Ohio in the first quarter of the year, and more than a third of them were from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where a decades-long civil war has displaced more than 7 million people. In 2023, 46% of all the refugees who came to Ohio were also from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Of the total 26,880 refugees that have come to the United States in the first quarter of this year, 3.4% came to Ohio, which makes us the 11th most popular state for refugees this year. However, it seems the pace of immigration here has slowed down quite a bit since November. March was the first month since then that the number of refugees coming here fell below 300.
For some reason, I just expected that Ukraine would be way up on this list.
I thought so too.
It just isn't, and it continues to be Congo.
Yeah, I would have thought Ukraine. I would have thought Syria.
Right.
I am surprised. Yeah. And actually, Ukraine, I looked at the list that we had in the story, and it looked like we only had about 10 refugees come from Ukraine in the first quarter. So I was really surprised because it seemed like there, I mean, we have a very robust Ukrainian community here who were very open to receiving people and helping them resettle. And so I was surprised. You're right.
Interesting story. You can check it out on cleveland.com. You're listening to Today in Ohio. What is a sanctuary museum and why is it in a shuttered church, Laura?
This is so cool. I had never heard of the Sanctuary Museum before Courtney Astolfi went off her City Hall beat to find this gem. This is housed in the former St. Hedwig's Parish on Madison Avenue in Lakewood's Birdtown neighborhood. It was built in 1905 to serve Polish immigrants. And remember when we shut down a whole bunch of churches in Cleveland? It was left empty. So this is a passion project started 13 years ago by a restoration artist named Lou McClung. So he restores all of these faded and worn down statues of Jesus, Mary, Catholic saints, and other religious figures. And so he shows them in this museum, and he also shows what it looked like before, where the church it came from, and then a QR code that has further information. So it sounds like you can get a whole lot of backstory on these artifacts that are displayed. There's a piece of the altar from Cleveland's former St. Francis Parish. There's St. Zita, who is the patron saint of Lost Keys. That statue showed up on McClung's doorstep after an ambitious parishioner took it upon himself to sponge paint her orange. So there's some great before and after pictures of what he can do with this work. And he does it next door in the former St. Hedwig's school.
There was so much worry back when Cleveland was going through all its church closings, and the bishop was brought to town from Boston, and his job was basically to shut down church after church after church. And all of the important materials, people were worried about what would happen to them. It sounds like they found a home here.
They did. And he also does private restoration work, but then this is this passion project for him. It's only open Saturdays from noon to 4 p.m. Admission is $12. So if it sounds like interesting to you, go see it. I guess they get people from all walks of life. They get art history lovers and Catholics, and they have some stuff on loan from the diocese itself, but just to marvel at these works of art.
Okay. You're listening to Today in Ohio. That's it for the Thursday episode. Thanks, Lisa. Thanks, Layla. Thanks, Laura. Thank you for listening. Come back Friday. We'll wrap up the week.